Welcome to Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the rare disease community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here at the World Orphan Drug Congress in Boston, speaking with Janet Lambert, CEO of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine. ARM, as it's known, is based in Washington, D.C., and is a nonprofit international advocacy association that aims to bring safe and effective cell and gene therapies to patients around the world. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Let's start by talking a bit about ARM. What is it, and why are you here at this conference?
ARM is a membership organization of 425 different organizations that care about, as you said in your introduction, bringing safe and effective advanced therapies to patients around the world. We're in a kind of golden age of new medicines. We have new categories of therapies that really stand to provide treatments and potentially even cures to patients suffering from a wide variety of indications. And all of these organizations have come together to work together to try to solve problems that stand between where we are today and where we want to get. And those activities are focused typically around legislative initiatives, regulatory initiatives, reimbursement-focused efforts, and manufacturing projects, manufacturing being a particular challenge in cell and gene therapy.
So in that regard, how do you differ from other organizations such as NORD, the Every Life Foundation, who's also here speaking, and other policy and advocacy groups that also deal with rare diseases and gene therapies?
Yeah, good question. I think NORD and Every Life are fantastic organizations that work very effectively to represent the patient voice in policy deliberations on these topics. ARM represents, in large measure, the developers of therapies. So our membership includes patient advocacy groups, research institutions. About 25% of our membership is nonprofit. About 75% are the companies developing these therapies. So we're a little bit more attuned to what are the commercial challenges of actually developing a therapy, getting it through a regulatory authority, whether that's in the United States or Europe, working with payers to establish a reasonable reimbursement. How do we manufacture that product? Those elements that are really more the challenge of a therapeutic developer than a patient advocacy group, for example.
And can you name some of the specific rare diseases that you deal with?
Yeah, definitely. So we're really excited about the potential for especially gene therapy to tackle a wide variety of rare diseases. Right now, one of the first gene therapies in the market is something called Zolgensma, which is a gene therapy for spinal muscular atrophy. We are excited about a couple of therapies anticipated to come to the market soon for hemophilia and sickle cell disease. There's a number of therapies in the pipeline for rare ophthalmological conditions. Luxturna is an early product on the market for those therapies. So those are just a few examples.
That's very interesting. Now, you mentioned Zolgensma, which, of course, has a retail price of $2.1 million. At that price, obviously, you're limited in how many patients can actually access that drug, although we know that it does wonders for babies born with spinal muscular atrophy. How can we bring the price down for these new therapies?
Yeah, I think sometimes, right, people are sort of startled by what the price of some of these therapies can be. That's understandable. We try to think about what's the value that this therapy is bringing, right? You've got a child that, absent some treatment, is going to die at age 2, a rather difficult and miserable death, right? So the fact that we have now this therapy that can actually save this child's life and allow the child to lead a sort of fully functioning full life is a dramatic thing. Right now, there's a special dynamic around rare disease in that you don't have, of course, by definition, that many patients. And so we actually have found that the price of these therapies isn't really the limiting factor. Both public and private payers have been willing see the value in the therapy and have been willing to pay for it on behalf of their clients or subscribers, if you will. I think as we start to get to larger indications like sickle and hemophilia, we'll face some additional challenges, to be sure. But if you look at hemophilia as an example, hemophilia is very, very expensive today. You know, it's if you were to compare the cost of
factor VIII, for example, right?
Right. I mean, severe hemophilia patients cost health systems around the world, you know, $100,000, $200,000 a year. So if you could cure that patient for $2 million, it could actually pencil as a way of saving the health system money. Of course, our priority, we'd be happy to help save the health system money, but our priority is actually in making the patient's life better. And we believe that these therapies will do that.
And not only that, but you have to factor in whether this is really a one-off or that patient will need to be redosed down the road.
Right. And some of that we don't know. The early trial indications, for example, one of the early gene therapies was for an indication commonly known as bubble boy disease. And we've now got 20 years of data on those patients, and we found that therapy is durable. Those patients don't need to be redosed. So the notion that these therapies really will have a long durability is definitely borne out by some of the data. Now, in other cases, it might actually be better for the patients to have a system where you redose. So my expectation is we'll be in a world where you have some combination of those two things. I'd also say that one of the exciting things about this space is that these therapeutic developers are willing to stand behind the therapies that they're developing in a way that's pretty different than traditional medicines. You know, they estimate that a lot of us are taking various pills and medications that really don't work for us, but we can't quite tell that, or there's sort of uncertainty about the effectiveness of various therapies. So part of a way of contending with and trying to kind of meet both those patients in need and payers halfway is that developers are offering what they call pay-per-performance options or outcome-based agreements for payers, which basically means, let's say my therapy costs $1,000. I say to you, I'll tell you what, you can pay me $200 a year for the next 5 years, and once a year we're going to check and see if it's still working. So if you're a hemophilia patient, have you been transfusion free for the last year or not? You know, it needs to be some very clear, simple metric. And if it's working for you, you pay another $200. If it's not working for you, you stop paying. And that way, at least you have the kind of shared commitment that what this is about is delivering value to the patient. It's not just about getting a one-time payment and moving on to the next thing. You know, it's a joint effort.
How relevant is the Orphan Drug Act when it comes to gene therapy?
So the Orphan Drug Act is quite relevant in the sense that it created a whole special set of incentives that helps it make economic sense for developers to address orphan diseases. You know, I think we see a future where gene and cell therapies treat many rare diseases and also treat many more prevalent diseases, but definitely the early work has all been in rare, and many of the companies in the rare space have taken advantage of various provisions in the Orphan Drug Act.
Are you concerned, as a Washington-based advocacy organization, that programs, legislation like the Orphan Drug Act could be in trouble and may not be renewed because of fiscal pressure?
We care a lot about the renewal of the Orphan Drug Act and the particulars therein. I think our expectation is that it will be renewed. I think the details will matter, but I would say we're paying attention to it. I wouldn't say that we're concerned at this point.
Okay, and I wanted to ask about the manufacturing end of things. Obviously, making tailor-made bespoke gene therapies is extremely expensive, and we're talking about very small quantities.
Correct.
How can the cost of actual manufacturing be brought down?
There's lots of efforts underway to improve the manufacturing capability, consistency, affordability of cell and gene therapies. And they vary quite a bit depending upon the therapy you're talking to. So, for example, in the cell therapy space, which is currently being used to treat some rare cancers. The challenge, as you've pointed out, is that you're extracting cells from a very sick patient. You're genetically engineering them at a different location. You're returning them to the site of the patient, and they're being infused in the patient. And there's a lot of complexity in that whole process. And also, you have a lot of variability in the starter material, the cells themselves. And often, they're not very, because the patient is not healthy, the cells are not very healthy, right? So there's a bunch of challenges in doing that. So one of the main efforts underway to try to make that therapeutic class more affordable is to try to say, can we do this with a allogeneic cell? Meaning it's not, I don't take Larry's cells or Janet's cells. We find a cell, a cell collection, basically, that can be universally given to Janet and Larry and Steven and anybody else who needs it. So it's an off-the-shelf cell therapy. It has the same genetic engineering that allows it to be a super cancer fighter when those cells are reintroduced into your body or introduced into your body. So that's probably the main effort that's underway now. And really the part of the hope of that is that it would simplify, it would speed, and it would improve the quality of those cell therapies, all while making it more affordable.
Very interesting. We're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you about newborn screening, since that came up in the panel that just concluded. And one of the speakers mentioned that whether you have a healthy child or a sick child could very well depend on, and as he called it, death by zip code. If you are born in Washington, D.C., or if the child is born in a hospital in Virginia versus Maryland, what disease they're screened for could vary, and so could the treatment, or maybe never even diagnosed or never even knows that the child has particular disease. And so I'm wondering if your organization is working on efforts for some kind of standardized newborn screening across all 50 states.
You know, we have begun at ARM to work at the state level, in part because, as you've just pointed out, a number of really important decisions about access to therapies are made at the state level. And right now, the way we do newborn screening is illogical, right? It is difficult that you have a different screening regime in one state and another, and that as we develop these therapies, so it makes sense to screen for those indications, it's a Herculean task to get 50 states to change their behavior. That's not, however, the only thing that states control that's really important. You know, states also make really important decisions about their Medicaid program, and a lot of rare indications and patients, especially children with rare diseases, are covered by state Medicaid programs. And state Medicaid directors and other policymakers at the state level make really important decisions about what's going to get covered. So one of the things ARM is working on is actually getting, we have a program now in Ohio and another in Texas as a kind of starting program to do more state work. To try to help state Medicaid directors and state policymakers understand what's coming in terms of the rare disease and prevalent disease pipeline of cell and gene therapies, and how they need to adapt their system in particular to enable these kind of pay-per-performance kind of arrangements that I described. You know, most state Medicaid programs are budgeted on an annual basis, so their ability to kind of integrate that kind of a model is pretty limited.
And also, certain states have Medicaid waivers for certain conditions and others don't,
right.
and there's a huge variability, as you said.
Right.
We did a story recently, for example, on Duchenne.
Yep.
And some organizations are sponsoring pilot projects in New York State, in North Carolina, I believe in Ohio also, to screen for Duchenne. Now, what's stopping all 50 states from screening for this condition? And is it necessarily a good idea to screen all babies for a specific condition? Is that always good?
I mean, I think the traditional thinking about newborn screening has been it's most helpful to screen if there's something you can do with the information. I find out you have Duchenne's. I can provide some therapy to you that will improve your condition, right? So I think that's the normal trigger point. So for Duchenne's, I think certainly the gene therapy solution to Duchenne's is still in development, right? We haven't yet produced a commercial Duchenne's product. But even so, it shouldn't be the process, to your kind of central point, the process of adapting and modernizing newborn screening, whether you use the threshold I just explained, which is, okay, once you can do something about it, you screen for it. It shouldn't be as challenging as it is. I know our colleagues at Novartis who make the Zolgensma drug, yes, you know, have really struggled with state-by-state newborn screening challenges. And given especially a therapy like that, where if you give a child Zolgensma at 2 weeks, there's a very different reality for that child than if you give that child Zolgensma at, you know, 1 year and 11 months. And yeah, their life will be quite different.
And some children
want to get it early.
And some children are on Zolgensma and Spinraza.
Right, right.
So I suppose in overall, you are upbeat about the future of gene therapy. And to conclude, I would ask you if you see a bright future immediately ahead for rare disease in general, cell and gene therapy.
I do. I think that, drug development always takes longer, and biology always throws us curveballs that we didn't anticipate. So, you know, we believe that this year could be actually a record-breaking year in terms of gene therapies for rare disease coming to market. Now, the bar is a little bit low, if I'm being honest, right? We don't have that many gene therapies in the market, so to increase the number. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited that we've got a number of new therapies at the point of coming to market. But really what we're looking for is, you know, the pipeline is really rich and products are moving through the developmental stages. And so I think we'll start to be, you know, we are very excited about moving from a world where we're counting the approvals, not as like 2 or 3 moving to 5 or 6, but it starts to be a regular matter, of course, that we're seeing regulatory authorities around the world approve 10 or 15 new gene therapies, many of whom which will address rare disease every year. And I think we're going to get there. I mean, the science is just moving at a breathtaking pace.
We'll check with you in 5 years.
Please do.
Janet, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you for listening.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.